Not long after my conversation with the three investigators interviewed for this program, ipilimumab was approved by the FDA for use in advanced melanoma and for another perspective on one of the most rapidly changing corners of medical oncology, I met with Dr. Jed Walchok, who began our conversation by commenting on melanoma.
First, let's talk about the tumor. Melanoma now, like many cancers, is known to be more than one single disease. It is a group of different diseases caused by different genetic mutations. The vast majority of melanomas diagnosed in the U.S. are cutaneous melanomas of the superficial spreading type that occur on intermittently sun-damaged skin. So sort of the person who goes out occasionally for a Caribbean holiday or on the weekend gets an occasional sunburn, but not the person who's outdoors all the time, not, you know, a landscaper or a construction worker, etc. Those folks have a reasonably high chance of having a mutation in a gene called BRAF, R-A-F, in their melanoma. And that is probably in the neighborhood of 50% of melanomas will have a BRAF mutation. And most of those BRAF mutations actually happen at one specific site in the BRAF gene.
Could I just pick up on this point you're making about intermittent sun exposure? How strong is that association?
I think that any association with sun exposure is accepted because it's the only controllable risk factor for melanoma. But, you know, sun exposure is not all that causes it. The best way that we understand the role of sun is that it is something that needs to interact with the genetics of the individual person. There is not a direct carcinogenic effect for increasing doses of sun exposure in melanoma like there is in squamous cell cancer of the skin, for example. But excessive sun exposure is a known risk factor for melanoma.
In terms of kind of the pathophysiology, as long as you brought it up, I think I have this concept of melanoma being more common in pale-skinned people. Is that, again, really the case? And is there a way to sort of put it together biologically with what you're saying about BRAF?
I don't know that there's a way to put it together with BRAF because the BRAF mutation does not bear the signature of an ultraviolet light-induced mutation. There are some mutations where, because of the specific DNA base pairs that are changed and the way that they are changed, it seems that that's a direct effect of the sunlight. With BRAF, it's harder to make that association.
I've got kind of DNA repair in my mind this morning because we've been working on this breast cancer project on PARP inhibitors. Any issues in terms of DNA repair in melanoma?
I'm quite sure that there are some, but they have not been well elucidated yet.
All right. Well, anyhow, let's get more to the practical things, particularly some of the agents and strategies that have been looked at.
So if we first start with BRAF, once BRAF was identified based upon the Cancer Genome Project as being important, then various different companies and groups started to look for inhibitors of BRAF. And now there are actually several that are in clinical testing. The most well-studied is a drug which was called PLX4032. And just earlier last week, results were announced from the phase 3 randomized trial of this drug, PLX4032, versus dacarbazine chemotherapy, which is the classical chemotherapy used for melanoma, showing that there is both a delay in progression-free survival as well as an improvement in overall survival in patients who receive the BRAF inhibitor compared with those who receive dacarbazine. We don't know the numbers yet. Specifically, we don't know how long that extension of overall survival is, but we do know that the study was stopped and that patients who were previously assigned to receive the chemotherapy are now allowed to cross over and receive the BRAF inhibitor. So this drug, PLX4032, the prior data showed that if a patient has a BRAF mutation, they have a 60 to 70% likelihood of having a major response.
And the waterfall plots kind of suggest that almost everybody had some response.
That's exactly right.
And now these substances, including this one Plexicon substance, these are small molecules?
That's correct.
TKIs?
They are inhibitors of the RAF kinase. That's correct. And the Plexxikon is one. There was data at ASCO this past year about a very similar drug, which showed very similar waterfall plots, very similar spectrum of activity, as well as side effects.
And what fraction overall of patients with metastatic melanoma have the BRAF mutation?
About 50%.
And does this fit, in your mind, kind of the classic model of, you know, an oncogene addiction, for example, that you see? We work a lot with your lung cancer colleagues there who have a tremendous interest in, you know, the EGFR TKIs. From your point of view, how is it similar or different to that?
It's similar in that its activity is strictly limited to those patients who have the mutation. So this class of drugs will do nothing to help patients who have a wild type or non-mutated BRAF. So that's a similarity. One difference is that I believe the recurrences may happen a bit more frequently with the BRAF inhibitors. We see patients beginning to become resistant after an average of about 6 or 7 months. And, I mean, of course, that's very disappointing, but it's also not unexpected because melanoma cells are likely to be addicted to more than one pathway. So if you take away BRAF, it causes this momentary pause in the relentless progression of the disease, which lasts at least 6 months in most people. But then there are likely other pathways which have become activated, and we are now uncovering other mutations that occur in these resistant tumors.
I mean, I think they are seeing that in lung cancer. Maybe it's not quite as quick as 6 months, but that's a whole issue. Is it a tumor mutation in the same way that you see in adenocarcinoma of the lung, for example?
It doesn't seem to be other mutations in BRAF. And this is very early and highly, highly topical in terms of current investigation. It seems to be other pathways contributing. It's quite different in some ways from imatinib in CML, where you get mutations in the actual target gene causing drug resistance. Here, I think we're seeing the biology of melanoma being different in that it's not just BRAF that's driving these tumors.
You're seeing, you know, again, I'm thinking about the EML4-ALK story in lung cancer, and oncologists are hearing about assays they need to start thinking about. What are the practicalities of getting a BRAF assay and actually obtaining an agent or one of these agents right now? One study, and when might they be available?
So right now, the PLX4032 molecule is available in an expanded access program around the country. And the only hurdle that has to be crossed to be a candidate for this therapy is to have genotyping done on a tumor specimen, which is now easily done by many contract laboratories, and in fact, many academic medical centers will do this in their molecular pathology departments. It usually takes 1 to 2 weeks at most once the unstained slides or tumor block is available. And it could be either the primary tumor or one of the metastases.
And is the test relatively straightforward? You know, like KRAS we found seems to be straightforward. Others, for example, breast cancer, is all the controversy about ER and HER2 testing. How straightforward is this assay?
This is much more straightforward. It's a yes or no. The mutation is there or it's not.
Right. So kind of same as what we're seeing with KRAS. What about side effects and tolerability of these agents and the Plexxikon agent particularly?
These agents do have side effects. They're in general quite tolerable. Rash and joint pain are quite common. The one class effect for all BRAF inhibitors that's rather interesting is the development of other skin cancers, specifically keratoacanthoma type of squamous cell cancers, which seems to be a paradoxical effect of RAF inhibition on cells that don't have a RAF mutation. And so, again, the underlying biology is quite interesting, but not yet completely elucidated yet.
Yeah, that's been one of the stranger stories that I've heard about. How does this manifest clinically? When does it happen? What kind of lesions?
It usually happens within a few weeks of starting, and they look like little pink papules. I mean, it doesn't really look like folliculitis. There's a real role for ongoing dermatologic surveillance in these patients. So we have everybody examined at baseline by a dermatologist, and then they go back every few weeks. And it's about a third to a quarter of patients where this becomes an issue. But again, these are very small lesions, not the big keratoacanthomas, and they're quite easily just simply excised in the office.
Would you say these are invasive cancers or just precancers?
I think they blur the line right now. We're actually learning more about them. It's a great question. There are rarer side effects that sometimes happen, elevation of liver function tests, but in general, people are able to take the medication.
Now, you mentioned dermatologic issues, and of course, there are lots of them with EGFR, TKIs. Is this like those kinds of reactions or different?
It's not the same kind of acneiform rash. It's more of a classical drug rash that can happen, an erythema, and specifically a photosensitivity as well. So it's very important that patients take precautions in terms of sun exposure.
We've worked a lot with, I guess, your fairly new colleague, Mario Lacouture. Is he involved with these patients also?
He's very involved. I mean, he's the one who's following these patients before, during, and after.
Any tricks you've picked up from him? He's got a lot of them in terms of EGFR agents.
Well, for this class of drugs, it's really, you know, careful examination and then excision. There's nothing more fancy than that.
Okay. All right. So, well, that's certainly a very interesting and important area to know about. Before we get on to other kinds of agents, what's the next step for these agents? Are they being looked at in earlier disease, for example?
I don't know whether there's a plan for earlier disease yet, but the next step for these agents is in combination. So specifically, the RAF inhibitors are being paired up with a MEK inhibitor. And the logic there is that MEK sits downstream of RAF. So if you imagine that for some reason there are other pathways feeding into MEK from the side of RAF, for example, then you can actually stop the signaling lower down in the pathway. And these are studies that are very early in their development, but I think it's terrific that we're now able to try to do multiple pathway blockade. And in addition, the other area that's receiving a lot of attention is the immunotherapy, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But combining these TKI therapies with the immunotherapy, so treating the tumor and also treating the patient at the same time, may actually be the solution to challenges that each of those individual lines of therapy have. For the TKIs, you know, the issue is very high activity, but not the degree of durability that one wants. For the immunotherapies, durability is a hallmark of the response to immunotherapy, but the number of patients who respond, especially early, is not at all as high as we would like it. So to marry these two concepts together is where the field is going. We've just started a trial combining a RAF inhibitor with a CTLA-4 blocking antibody. There are plans to bring the Plexxikon BRAF inhibitor together with the ipilimumab CTLA-4 blocking antibody. And that's a really important study that I think shows off the best of our community, because it's two lines of therapy that are now complementary in their potential activity. And also it shows how two very big companies can actually cooperate with investigational drugs for the good of patients.
Yeah, I was thinking, it seems like such a long time ago since Dr. O'Day did that plenary presentation, but I guess actually it's less than a year.
Yeah, it's just a few months.
So maybe you can take a shot. First of all, going back over the biology, I can't say I still quite get it. I was just looking at his slides again and the papers that you've been involved with on this topic. Can you talk a little bit about how we think this works or how we know it works?
Yeah, great question. So CTLA-4 is a molecule that sits on the surface of T cells, and its role is to stop T cells from getting overly activated. So the best analogy is that it is the brake that prevents our immune system from accelerating too quickly. We know that without CTLA-4, the immune system can actually do significant damage in mice. These experiments were done where if a mouse lacks CTLA-4, it actually cannot live more than 3 weeks without T cells overrunning every organ in the body. So CTLA-4 plays a non-redundant role in restraining the immune system from reacting too hard against the self. Now, the idea behind blocking CTLA-4 with an antibody like ipilimumab is that by blocking CTLA-4, you will temporarily allow the immune system to accelerate more than it otherwise would. But because this is not a permanent blockade, antibodies have about a 2-week half-life, you're not as concerned with the very severe consequences of complete loss of CTLA-4, like in the mouse studies. So the theory is that if melanoma is inherently immunogenic to the body. But mechanisms that hold back the immune system are preventing full-blown tumor immunity from having a therapeutic effect on the tumor. By blocking CTLA-4, we are temporarily allowing the immune system to work harder than it otherwise would be allowed to. The governor has been removed, and therefore it may cause a more productive response against melanoma.
And I guess as long as you're bringing that up before we even get into the efficacy, that does lead to problems also clinically.
So there are certainly side effects from this class of drugs. There are two CTLA-4 blocking antibodies that have been in clinical trials, ipilimumab and tremelimumab, and they have quite similar types of clinical activity, quite similar spectrums of side effects, different clinical trials with different results thus far, with ipilimumab being the one that's right now being considered for FDA approval. And the side effects, not surprisingly, are those resembling excessive activation of the immune system. They really are tissue-specific inflammatory events. The most common areas affected are the skin and the GI tract. And the important thing to take away from the discussion is that with proper vigilant management, these side effects are reversible. At the beginning, before anybody knew what the side effects were of this class of drugs, there were some deaths from colon perforation, from the diarrhea that occurred and the colitis that ensued. But now we know that diarrhea in a patient treated with a CTLA-4 blocking antibody needs to be taken seriously. It shouldn't be treated like irinotecan diarrhea, you know, with anti-motility agents, but rather it needs to be treated like inflammatory bowel disease with corticosteroids. And with proper application of corticosteroids, those side effects can be extinguished within a few weeks.
So just thinking back to your pharmacologic model, I guess, for this agent, if you, I guess, would conceptualize a patient having one of these toxicities has had the immune system driven too hard, at least for them, how do steroids sort of pathophysiologically enter the picture?
That's a great question. We're not sure how steroids are specifically working on the side effect. I mean, I think we all know that steroids are lympholytic. They kill lymphocytes. They are anti-inflammatory. The real mystery here is why the application of steroids interferes with the side effects, but heretofore does not interfere with the anti-tumor effect, that there is some difference between the pathway underlying the anti-tumor activity of these drugs that differs in terms of steroid sensitivity from the side effect pathway.
So just to diverge out on that point for a second, because our listeners have heard Tom Lynch talk about his work with this agent, ipilimumab, in lung cancer. And he raised the question of the fact that they actually, because they were giving it with chemo that required corticosteroids, that maybe they didn't see the benefit that might have been seen. They didn't see the toxicities that might have been seen. Can you sort of say in general that if a patient's getting corticosteroids, they might not get the benefit anti-tumor-wise of this agent?
I don't think we can say for certain yet. Both chemotherapy and also steroids done concurrently with anti-CTLA-4 could potentially interfere. But some chemotherapies might actually potentiate the activity of the drug because it provides an antigen by killing tumor cells. I think timing is very important. You know, giving steroids up front along with anti-CTLA-4 antibodies may be harmful. But when we've been using them in the treatment of side effects, the steroids have usually been used 6, 8, 10 weeks later. And that could be why we don't see the interference with the anti-tumor effect.
So there's obviously tremendous excitement within the melanoma research community about this. But can you go through the efficacy data? Because it's kind of actually not that straightforward for somebody outside the field to actually understand.
I don't think it's straightforward for anybody.
Well, that's good. That's good to know.
Yeah. So the responses to anti-CTLA-4, and in fact, to any immunotherapy, actually, need to be thought about very differently than responses to, say, chemotherapy or TKIs. Because again, the paradigm is that with immunotherapy, we're treating the patient and not the tumor. And so all of the response criteria that we have thought about for decades have been based upon a chemotherapy paradigm, that you're damaging DNA, and then 4 to 6 weeks later, you're going to see the tumor get smaller. With immunotherapy, you may actually see the tumors grow, before they get smaller. So picking an empiric point in time and saying we're going to image everybody at, say, week 12, and if you don't respond by then you're never going to respond, that is going to really prevent the recognition of, I would say, somewhere between 10 and 25% of people who will ultimately respond to the drug. You need to have a very open mind about the fact that some people will get worse because their immune system needs a longer period of time to find an antigen relevant to the tumor and get rid of that tumor. And in fact, the paradigm of having new lesions represent automatic progression of disease also needs to be reconsidered. Because in the context of a patient treated with immunotherapy, some tumors may get smaller, a new tumor may come up, but that tumor may just take longer for the immune system to recognize, and it, in fact, may go away later. So we, as a community of immunotherapy investigators, along with colleagues at Bristol, have proposed a new set of response criteria called the immune-related response criteria, which take these facts into consideration. And it's not complicated science that is involved in these response criteria. It really makes just two distinctions from standard WHO or RESIST criteria. It just says confirm progression. In the same way that we usually confirm response, you must confirm progression. So if you have a patient who at week 12 shows that they're getting worse, but they feel okay, they're not clinically deteriorating, their performance status is maintained, just their scans look worse, repeat the scans in 4 to 6 weeks. And somewhere between 10 and 25% of patients will actually improve in that period of time. The second distinction is that the total tumor burden, new lesions plus the index lesions, have to be considered when judging response. So if you see some efficacy with the index lesions regressing, but you see one new tumor, by standard response criteria, those patients go into the category of drug failure. In this case, they don't. The total tumor burden is what you're measuring.
But when you talk about response, you know, we think tumors getting smaller. Mm-hmm. Does that actually happen with these agents?
It does. It definitely, I mean, we've had patients who have had complete radiographic, you know, regressions. We've had patients who've had bona fide partial responses. And we've also had a significant number of people who've had stable disease. And this is not just stable disease that, you know, is there on one scan and gone on the next. I have patients who've been stable for 4 years. I mean, their scans look just as abnormal now as they did 4 years ago, but they're not any worse, and the patients feel fine.
But am I correct in saying that the actual response rate, I mean, and again, I'm not sure when it's done or, you know, this issue about delayed and all these other things, but am I correct in saying the response rate in these studies actually is not increased? The design of these studies have been, how would you describe it, phase two?
No, there's been phase three data. Steve O'Day's data from ASCO, which was subsequently published by Steve Hody in the New England Journal, that was a phase three trial. And the response rate to CTLA-4 blocking antibodies by standard response criteria is between 5 and 15%. But once you push the envelope to including this long-term stable disease, then you're edging closer to 25 or 30%. And we actually see from the phase two program of ipilimumab, but 25, 30% of people alive for more than 2 years, which for a disease with a 9 to 11 month median survival from diagnosis is quite respectable.
Can you go through what the current numbers are? I guess, you know, those published in the New England Journal, are they the most recent ones? And what specifically are the numbers?
Well, the numbers from the phase three trial were basically that there was just over 3 month improvement in overall survival when you compared ipilimumab treated patients with patients receiving an active control, which was an experimental vaccine
right,
in that study. So there was just over 3 month increase in overall survival, and there was about a doubling of the number of patients alive at the landmark time points of 1 year and 2 years if they received ipilimumab. And I think that's the easiest description of the data for patients to get their arms around.
You know, sometimes it is difficult for people sort of outside to really get a feel for this. Are there patients that you've actually taken care of that you could talk about in terms of clinically what happened to them, in terms of actually having meaningful anti-tumor effect that you could see clinically?
Absolutely. So one of the first patients that I treated on the phase 3 trial that was, again, presented by Steve O'Day and published by Steve Hody, was a young woman who had widely metastatic melanoma diagnosed at the age of 22, including brain, thoracic cavity, adrenal metastases, had been through multiple lines of prior chemotherapy and high-dose IL-2, as well as brain radiation, went on this study, and has essentially had a complete remission now for over 4 years. And actually went on to have 2 babies in the meantime.
And did she have any of the side effects you were describing before? And is there any correlation, again, kind of thinking back to EGFR TKIs, between side effects and benefit?
So this patient did have a rarer side effect. She had hypothyroidism. There is a group of endocrinopathies that can occur because of inflammation of the thyroid or the pituitary, and more rarely the adrenal gland, which can cause long-term deficiency of hormones. And some patients do require hormone supplementation long-term. There is certainly a relationship between patients who have any immune-related adverse event, any one of the side effects, and the likelihood of them having clinical benefit. What I stress to patients, though, is that one does not need to have a severe life-threatening event. You don't need to perforate your colon in order to get benefit. It can be something as simple as pruritus or some mild diarrhea that can put you in the category of being more likely than the average person of responding to the drug.
And what more do we know about who responds to the drug? Are there, I don't know if it's analogous to pharmacogenetics, because now we're talking about the immune system, but are there natural variations in sort of people's immune system that affect, you know, how they respond to these agents?
That's a really important question, and it's the research focus of my group and others. We have not yet identified a predictive biomarker which would identify an enriched subset for response or for toxicity. We have identified some pharmacodynamic biomarkers that you can pick up along the way. So patients who have an increase in their total lymphocyte count are more likely to respond, but that doesn't help you up front. We are eagerly searching for something that would identify this population from the get-go.
And where are we in terms of, you know, new trials looking at these agents? You mentioned combining them with the BRAF inhibitors. What else is going on?
I think that's a very important line of investigation. The other trial which we are participating in as well as others is combining 2 different immunotherapies together. There's another antibody directed toward a molecule called PD-1, and this had some phase 2 data presented at ASCO by Mario Schnall from Yale on behalf of a group of us. And PD-1 is, if you will, the emergency brake on T cells. It is a molecule which mediates programmed cell death of a T cell. And not unexpectedly, melanoma cells express the ligand which causes this T cell death on their surface. So this is really the ultimate weapon that a tumor cell can use to defend itself against an attacking T cell, as it actually has the ligand which triggers apoptosis of a T cell that's coming to, in fact, kill it. And by blocking this interaction with an antibody, the current antibody that's in trials in melanoma is called MDX1106. And there is some very encouraging data in melanoma, in renal cell cancer, and in lung cancer as well, documenting the importance of this PD-1 pathway in the immunobiology of these tumors. And so there can be some very nice responses seen in patients with melanoma by blocking PD-1. So not unexpectedly, there is now a trial combining ipilimumab with the anti-PD-1 antibody to see whether we can get an even more potent type of tumor immunity with this combined antibody therapy. And there's certainly preclinical models supporting this. And we're just in the phase 1 kind of dose escalation, going very carefully, looking for any, you know, potential synergistic side effects. So we're proceeding very cautiously.
I guess melanoma has always had the, quote, reputation of being sort of immune-related. What is it about melanoma that would make it more susceptible to this kind of treatment? And what other kinds of tumors would you speculate maybe would respond?
I think that melanoma enjoys this reputation partially because of some biology that it has, but also because of its frustrating resistance to standard cytotoxic therapy. So it was sort of thrown to the immunotherapists early on, saying, well, nothing else works against this cancer, so why don't you folks look at it? But there are some things about melanoma that make one believe that it does have a distinct relationship with the immune system. First of all, it can express MHC class II molecules on its surface, which is something as opposed to MHC class I. Class II molecules are usually reserved for antigen-presenting cells or other immune cells. So there's something about it that sets it up to show things to the immune system a bit more obviously than the average other epithelial cancer. In addition, we know that melanoma patients can make spontaneous immune responses to antigens found on melanoma. Melanoma patients can develop vitiligo in the context of metastatic disease. And in addition, melanoma undergoes rarely spontaneous remission. And, you know, if you exclude divine intervention, really the only thing that can explain that is an immune response. So I think that melanoma is sort of the low-hanging fruit for immunotherapy. The other one is renal cell cancer, obviously. There's data for IL-2, for interferon, responses in renal cell carcinoma. But I think with drugs like ipilimumab, which sort of just open the immune system up wider than it otherwise would to see targets on cancer, if you have a way of killing some tumor cells, even if they're not melanoma, if they're lung cancer, for example, if you have a way to release antigen to the immune system and then cut off the brakes of the immune system by blocking CTLA-4, this could be an approach that, when combined, could be applicable to a variety of cancers. I'll throw out there prostate cancer also, because there's a phase 3 trial right now of ipilimumab in prostate cancer. And as you know, prostate cancer, not classically considered an immune-responsive disease, very classically a hormonally responsive disease, but there have now been meaningful clinical responses seen in patients treated with ipilimumab for advanced prostate cancer, and specific trials combining it with radiation to a painful bone lesion, as an example, as a way to release some antigen.
Of course, we have seen, you know, cipulucyl T in prostate cancer, which I guess is more along the lines of a, quote, vaccine. Is that the way you conceptualize it?
I think that it is best considered a cell therapy. I mean, I guess that does also help to break down this paradigm also, that there's melanoma and renal cell as the immunogenic cancers and everything else isn't. But you're absolutely correct that, you know, the positive data for cipulucel T does identify prostate cancer as being responsive to immune modulation. The other one, ovary cancer also. Lots of spontaneous immune responses noted in ovary cancer. And I think that's a disease that begs to be attacked more aggressively with immunotherapy because it really is very chemotherapy sensitive, but for a temporary period of time. So again, you know, we see the durability being the challenge for therapies that attack the tumor directly, but that is really the hallmark of immunotherapy.
You mentioned before, I believe, the possibility of integrating chemotherapy along with immunotherapy. Is that kind of along the lines of what you've just been talking about, releasing the antigen, or what's going on? And what about clinical trials looking at chemotherapy plus ipilimumab?
So there's a currently still blinded phase 3 trial of dacarbazine alone versus dacarbazine with ipilimumab, which will hopefully address that question. I mean, I think that chemotherapy could potentially serve several purposes in combination with immune modulation. First of all, a source of antigen. That's correct. But second of all, we now know that some chemotherapies actually can potentiate the immune response. It's very paradoxical compared to the classical teaching that chemotherapy is immunosuppressive. But we now know that as the immune system rebounds after chemotherapy, it is actually much more active than it was even at baseline. So there's this period of homeostatic proliferation where if you knock the immune system down with significant doses of chemotherapy, once it bounces off the nadir, it is seeing things more avidly, it is proliferating more potently than it was before. And so the peri-chemotherapy period may be a prime time for immune modulation.
Are there any chemotherapeutic agents or regimens in particular that seem like they kind of have a future in that regard?
The ones that have been studied very much so far have been combinations of cyclophosphamide with fludarabine. That's the regimen that the NCI surgery branch uses to condition patients before giving them infusions of T cells. Because, in fact, by eliminating the endogenous T cells, it actually allows the transferred T cells more of an opportunity to take hold and proliferate.
Any comments about the use of chemotherapy just sort of clinically in metastatic melanoma? What are the agents that you generally consider early on, and how do you sort of select?
So the one approved chemotherapy agent for melanoma that still does get some use is dacarbazine. You know, it has somewhere between a 7 and 15% response rate with a fairly transient period of benefit. It's quite easy to tolerate. The oral congener of dacarbazine is a drug called temozolomide, which does not have an FDA indication for treatment of melanoma. We do use it in the melanoma community because of the ease of oral administration and the fact that it crosses the blood-brain barrier. And it has very similar activity to dacarbazine in melanoma. Other drugs which have been used that have some track record of melanoma include the platinating agents, cisplatin and carboplatin, the taxanes, the vincas, and the nitrosoureas. They all have sort of this 20-ish percent response rate with the ongoing challenge of durability. Combinations of drugs have certainly more activity in terms of response rate, which does not seem to translate into improved overall survival, but certainly does introduce the possibility of more side effects. So we're quite judicious about offering combination chemotherapy to people, but there is still a role for chemotherapy because, I mean, there's a population of patients out there who will not have a BRAF mutation, who will have progressed on immunotherapy and need a response.
What about nab-paclitaxel specifically?
I don't really have any experience with it. Steve O'Day has done some very interesting phase 2 trials with that drug alone, and I think combining it with bevacizumab, which is very intriguing. And so I'd like to see more of that because we certainly do have an ongoing need for different therapies.
Any questions that you get from oncologists in community practice that we haven't touched on today?
I think the most common question we get really is, you know, what trials do you have to offer for my patient? And I think a lot of the initial management is now going to be able to be easily done in the community because there will be, you know, hopefully two new approved drugs. And in addition, the molecular characterization of patients' melanomas will be something that can be easily ordered. That so a doctor in the community will be able to look at the BRAF status of a patient and know how to approach this in the era of molecular personalized medicine. Before we leave that topic, I would just say that there's a very small subset of melanoma patients, those with acral melanomas and mucosal melanomas, and melanomas of chronically sun-damaged skin, like on the face or the top of the head or the top of the ears, that have a mutation in the c-KIT gene. And that really opens the door to clinical trials of KIT inhibitors, of which imatinib is the best known. And we are actually leading a clinical trial. My colleague Richard Carvajal is leading a trial nationwide of nilotinib, which is a second-generation KIT inhibitor, versus dacarbazine, which is, in fact, a crossover trial, which makes accrual quite attractive for patients with KIT-mutated melanoma.
And what fraction of melanoma is that?
It's small. It's probably 5% of all melanomas. But once you start looking at the anatomic distribution of the melanomas, the acrals, the mucosals, and the chronically sun-damaged skin, it's probably a quarter to a third of that subset.
And have objective responses been seen with these agents?
Absolutely. Richard Carvajal presented at ASCO 2009 data from the first trial of imatinib. Steve Hody had a paper in JCO a few years ago of a case report documenting very clearly very rapid responses to imatinib. Again, they don't last forever. You know, they have the challenges that most TKIs do. But for patients with very advanced disease, even a few months of disease control can really provide a meaningful benefit.
You mentioned spontaneous remission of melanoma. Have you yourself observed cases of that in your practice?
I personally have not observed a durable remission of widespread metastatic disease. I have certainly seen patients who've had regressed primaries, So they had a pigmented lesion that they can remember in the distant past, and now they have an area of depigmentation at that site and may end up with a lymph node metastasis 15 or 20 years later.